patterns. Okay, so one way here is short for the one-way measurement model of quantum computation. And pattern is just basically the name for how algorithms are described in that model. Okay, so first, I'll be describing something about easily understood patterns, patterns which are essentially circuit-like in their structure. And then I'll move on to less easily understood patterns, which are the things that would be most interesting from a computer science perspective. Okay, so first, I'm going to describe a somewhat different set of elementary gates from what you usually see. It won't be anything earth-shaking, but just something to set the foundation a little bit. So basically, we know that control knot in the set of all one-qubit unitaries are universal for quantum computation. We usually describe this, for instance, Nielsen and Chuang describes this. You can use control Z in place of control X. You can get that from control Z in unitary, Hadamards, sorry. The Hadamard, of course, and Z rotations. Now, we can instead consider an alternative set of gates, a controlled Z and these J thetas for various angles theta. So, for example, for theta equal to 0, we get the Hadamard gate. And then, basically, by composing Hadamard with general phase gates, we get these J gates in general. So, basically, that controlled Z and these J gates for arbitrary angles is universal for quantum computation. For approximately universal quantum computation, the story is pretty much the same. We can basically instead replace the general Z rotations with rotation by pi over 4, the so-called pi over 8 gate. And we can come up with a discrete set of gates using the J operators by using basically angles which are multiple of pi over 4, pretty much for exactly the same reason. The gate J pi over 4, so here for k equals 1, actually features prominently in Nielsen and Chuang's proof of the universality of this set for a single qubit quantum computation. So in some sense, it's a bit of a natural gate. Okay, and so then we get for integer multiples of pi over 4, this set is universal for approximate quantum computation. So if you take only three things away from this presentation, the third thing that you should take away is basically the existence of these sorts of operators, which are fairly nice for producing quantum operations. Now, we can use these J theta gates to describe quantum computation in terms of measurements. So consider this single qubit state here. This state can be, this state is just something on the equator of the block sphere. So here I've got the z-axis. Over here I've got the plus state. And over here I've got, well, the plus y state. This, the state plus theta will just be the state on the block equator which has an angle of theta with respect to the plus state. And minus theta is just the state on the other side of the block sphere from it. So how do we perform a J operation using these states, or measurement with respect to these states? Well, we can take just an arbitrary single qubit state on an input qubit I, and we prepare an output qubit in the plus state. We perform a controlled Z operation between the two, entangling them. And then we measure the input qubit in with respect to the plus theta minus theta basis. And so what we'll get is we'll get a collapse, and we'll get some measurement result. So if we have plus theta on the first qubit, the input qubit, then the result will be just J minus theta of the original input state. And you can verify this just by computation, fairly simple. If you get minus theta instead, then you'll get the same thing, except that you'll have an additional X operation performed on it. Now, we'll refer to these measurement results as 0 and 1 for reasons that will become fairly useful later on. So if you want to perform a J operation, all you have to do is, if you get minus theta, kind of what we think of as an undesirable measurement result, you perform an X correction, and you do nothing in the case that you've got the measurement result that you wanted. Okay, so this is a J operation using measurements, but also controlled Z, and also poly operations. So this might seem like, you know, more work than is really worth it. So why would we think of doing it this way? Well, it's because when we try and compose these operations to come up with more general quantum operations, we get some nice properties. So basically just by assembling these measurement patterns and other controlled Z operations to perform entanglement, we can get more intricate things. So suppose you have a 3-qubit state on qubits A, B, and C, and you want to perform a J operation on the middle one here, and then entangle the result with the top and the bottom qubits. Well, I just showed you how you can basically replace this J operation with this block here, where you first prepare a D qubit in the plus state, and we scoot A and C over. We entangle B and D together. We measure B, and we get some bit 0 or 1, depending on the measurement result. And then we perform a correction on D. And then basically that performs the J operation. And then we can then perform an entanglement between the 3 qubits that we have left. Well, we can think of trying to commute these entanglement operations past this correction operation, and also past this measurement. Basically, this measurement is on B. It doesn't affect any of the qubits involved here. So what do we get when we perform that? Well, we start again with a 3-qubit state on A, B, and C. We prepare the qubit D in the plus state. We entangle all of them together in a pattern here, basically just collecting all the controlled Z operations that we had on this step into one place. We measure the qubit B again, and then we perform corrections on all 3 of the qubits. And what we've done here is we've just commuted the X correction here past the controlled Z operations, and we get a couple of induced Z operations on A and C. So basically, now we've got the same 3-qubit state that we would have gotten if we had just performed this operation here. Now, the nice thing about this is that if we keep on going and perform quantum operations on, well, A, D, and C, we can keep on doing this process of commuting all of the entanglement to the very start, so that we can have a computation where all entangling operations are done at the very beginning with a bunch of commuting entanglement operations. So you can think of them as being performed actually simultaneously. Physically, it depends on your setup, of course. And also, instead of performing these correction operations, if A, C, and D are to be measured themselves later, we can absorb those poly operations into the basis which we perform the measurements. So we get adaptive measurements, basically measurements just depending on the results of previous measurements. Now, I'm going to keep on referring to performing X corrections and Z corrections on qubits and leave the idea that absorbing them into the basis of measure implicit. So what we get out of this is we get a model of computation where quantum operations are given by preparing a bunch of auxiliary qubits in the plus state in addition to some input subsystem that has some arbitrary quantum state that we want to transform. We perform entangling operations on pairs of qubits in some specified way, and they all commute again. And then we do a sequence of adaptive single-qubit measurements, or measurements and corrections and measurements and corrections, whichever you prefer. Something which I didn't mention earlier is that basically the basis in which you perform the measurement will always be one of 2 choices. If all of your measurement results are basically the states that you want, that's an unlikely possibility. But if that occurs, then they'll all be in one basis. And for any given qubit, there's only one other basis that you have to think of possibly having to perform the measurements in. So that's a fairly nice thing. Not only are they adaptive, but it's only one of 2 possibilities in a simple way. And all of these measurement bases are on the equator of the Bloch sphere. And then finally, on an output subsystem, which you haven't measured yet, you perform some Pauli corrections. And basically, this is universal for quantum computation just by the universality of this gate set, for whatever reasonable set of measurement angles you want to consider. So physicists are somewhat interested in this because it's kind of an unusual way of presenting quantum operations, or at least unusual to people used to thinking in the circuit model. And it has some features which could be nice, but I'm a computer scientist. I don't really have the qualifications to talk about that sort of thing. So why would a computer scientist be interested in this model? Well, it's basically the questions that you can ask about it in order to understand a different way of thinking of quantum computation. So, for example, a simple question I could ask is, well, is the measurement order that you have to perform the measurements of the qubits in unique? And the answer is, well, not usually. I mean, as a simple example, if you wanted to just perform a string of J operations on a single qubit, well, actually, on 2 different qubits, not interacting with one another, then you'd have to basically perform it in this order, where these are where this is an input subsystem that you have in an arbitrary state, and this is an output subsystem that you want to leave unmeasured. You have to perform it in this sequence for this chain, and this sequence for this chain, but between the two, they're more or less independent. And generally speaking, there will be a lot of times when you have some choice in the measurement order. So we can think of them as a partial order if you want, just where some things do depend on other things. But note, it's not necessarily true that any two qubits will have some necessary order. So can you discover a measurement order if you only have partial information? So for example, say you just have the input qubits and the output qubits that you want to perform operations on, and your entanglement operations, which I've described here with kind of lines in my diagram. Can you discover a measurement order? And also, well, what if you have an algorithm? Can you easily describe this algorithm in the circuit model? Well, the answer to both of these is sometimes yes. And the example that I'll describe is when the pattern, which is to say the algorithm, has a flow. So I'll kind of just start describing abstractions here in the one-way measurement model. We're interested in how information is transmitted in a geometry. So a geometry is just a graph. For those physicists among you, a graph is just a collection of points in the plane, for example, and line segments connecting them. We call these vertices and edges. And we say that two vertices are neighbors of one another if they're connected by an edge. And we're interested in if we have an input subsystem that we prepare in some arbitrary state. And we'll have an output subsystem which we'll leave unmeasured. And we're interested in how information is transmitted from one to the other. Now, this thing as a whole, I don't know if I mentioned, is called a geometry. We can think of it as basically a description of a family of states. So you have an input state, and then the thing as a whole will describe a collection of entangled states depending on what that input state was. If the input subsystem is just the empty set, then this describes what's called a graph state. It's just one particular state. Yes, so then flows. Well, okay. A flow is basically something which is given by a function f here. What it will do is for each qubit outside of the inputs, or sorry, outside of the outputs, so each qubit that will be measured, it describes a qubit. It will describe a qubit that you perform an x correction on depending on the measurement result of the qubit that you're measuring. So this is just mapping the qubits that you measure to the qubits that you perform x corrections on. We have this partial order, which is describing a possible way in order to perform the measurements and corrections in order to get a unitary operation. So it's not necessary. For instance, well, I'll show later how in this particular geometry, this qubit is described as being measured earlier than this qubit. In general, you can measure all the input qubits in whatever order you like. So this is just one possible ordering, not the necessary ordering. And we have these three conditions here, which I'll explain in a bit. So this first condition here, basically, whenever you're performing a correction, the qubit that you're performing an X correction on has to be adjacent. This tilde represents the adjacency relation, the neighborhood relation. It has to be adjacent to the qubit that you're measuring. The second condition here says that, well, the qubit that you're measuring, if you measure one qubit, then the qubit that you perform the correction on has to be measured afterwards. That's fairly straightforward. And this third condition is basically describing how we commuted the X corrections past the controlled Z operations. Basically, that anything which is adjacent to this qubit, I'll call it the successor qubit for short. So anything which is adjacent to the successor qubit will have a Z correction induced on it for any given qubit. So for this particular geometry, well, A and B, B is the successor of A. So B will have an X correction performed on it based on the measurement result of A. And so B has to be measured after A. Here we have C and D. They're adjacent to B, so they'll have Z corrections induced on them depending on the measurement result of A. In this description, they're also measured after A. And then we continue so on and so forth. Because U has to come after C, then U also has to come after A, fairly straightforward. Now, yes. For each vertex, basically, any geometry that has a flow, then if you want to perform a measurement algorithm based on that flow, then you can easily describe this measurement algorithm in terms of a circuit. You know, you can basically transform back and forth between the circuit model and geometries, patterns that have flows. So for each vertex, what we're going to want to do, for the input vertices, we create two wires, which will be basically the basis of our circuit. And for each vertex, here we've got these two vertices we're thinking of as having been induced into the circuit. We want to translate each of the edges into various quantum operations. And here we have basically the arrows pointing out we'll call flow edges. And you want to translate the flow edges last. And you have to find some ordering of the qubits, this will be the flow ordering actually, in which you do the translation. So for example, we first take all the operations connected to this vertex. We get a controlled Z operation between the two wires, and then some J operation. And then we can take all the edges coming out of this qubit, and we get another controlled Z operation, and now a J operation on the top wire. Here we have basically this output qubit sitting by itself. It has nothing pointing into it, which means that basically it's an ancilla prepared in the plus state. And then we perform a controlled Z operation between this wire, which is described by this sequence of arrows, and the ancilla, and then another J operation, and we keep going on like this. Now, all of this is independent of the measurement angles. This is because flows are a property of the geometry rather than the entire pattern. I haven't talked much about the measurement angles. These are sometimes essential in determining whether or not, well, they're usually important in determining whether or not an operation will perform a unitary operation. But any geometry which has a flow, no matter what the measurement angles are, you can use it to perform a unitary, particularly if you do the measurements in the order of the flow. So basically, just what I've described here, geometries with flows can be easily translated into quantum circuits on a small number of qubits. What I mean by a small number of qubits is the number of qubits that's in this output set here. Of course, you could always turn this into a quantum circuit on a large number of qubits just by taking this geometry, taking all these auxiliary qubits and just turning them into ancillas in a circuit, but that's not very interesting. What you're interested in is whether you can, because you can always take a circuit and translate it into, turn it into a measurement pattern, kind of in the way that I was describing with composition of patterns, you'll get something that has a flow as a result of that. And basically, this is showing that you can do the reverse operation as well. And for when the input set is equal to the output set in size, then basically a flow can be efficiently founded for a geometry if it exists. Now, so the problem, well, this is basically going to show that what we'll be interested in is what happens if you come up with patterns that can't be so easily translated into circuits. And in order to do this, we need to move beyond flows. And there are geometries that are interesting that don't have flows. So this geometry, for example, I'm just going to state that it has a flow, sorry, that it doesn't have a flow. Actually, if you were interested, you could figure this out fairly simply, a small example. And nonetheless, there's an order for measuring the qubits, all of them measuring them in the plus minus basis, such that it performs a swap operation with a couple of Hadamards. Now, I guess this isn't intended to be in any way obvious from just looking at this. But if it doesn't have a flow, everything that I've told you about so far, how you would perform a measurement operation, everything that I've told you so far has to do with flows. So how would we actually perform this operation? Well, we could perform this operation if we could find a correction scheme. But if we don't know a correction scheme, then how do we even know what operation it performs? Well, the thing that I guess there are a couple of things that I've been leaving out so far. And one of them is that basically what we're really interested in thinking about is post-selection. So if you take only two things out of this talk, the second thing should be that in the one-way measurement model, what we're interested in doing is basically post-selection of all our measurement results. Now, some people might be saying, well, wasn't there this guy who proved that post-selection can give you a ridiculous amount of computational power? Well, in general, yes. But the thing is that in this particular special case, it can be efficiently done. And the reason for this is exactly because when you get the incorrect measurement result, you can always steer back with just a Pauli correction. So in order to talk about what operation it performs, even if you don't know what the correction operations are, is just think about post-selection. So what these algorithms are doing, you prepare a bunch of auxiliary qubits, so everything which isn't in the output, you prepare it in the plus state. You perform a bunch of controlled Z operations, and then instead of actually performing measurements, you think of projecting onto the plus state for everything which isn't an output. And you'll get some matrix. This matrix won't necessarily be unitary, but sometimes it'll be proportional to a unitary by some real scalar factor. And when this happens, then you know that your geometry can have, or it may have, rather, some collection of correction operations that will allow you to perform a unitary operation. And when you don't have, when it doesn't represent a unitary, then what it's telling you is that there's no way that you can perform correction operations to perform a unitary operation. Now, so here I've got a bunch of theta v's. So this is basically the measurement angle for each qubit. We can actually take that out of the projection and turn it into basically a bunch of z rotations. So all these z rotations are doing is for each qubit, rotating, performing a rotation from the plus minus theta basis to the plus minus basis so that you can just do your projection nicely in the plus minus basis. And the nice thing about these middle two maps is that it's a diagonal unitary, or what's called by some people a phase map. And this phase map is basically the first step towards trying to work generally with unitaries in the one-way measurement model, asking, for example, when you can come up with a correction scheme for a geometry that represents a unitary operation in this way. Okay, so now determining what this matrix is, even ignoring the fact that you have to worry about some scalar factor, is going to be computationally expensive, but at the very least it's well-defined. And this is what we care about when we're talking about what operation a geometry represents. And when the input size is equal to the output size, again, if it's not unitary or not proportional to a unitary at least, then there won't be any correction scheme to make it a unitary operation. Now, finally, to find a correction scheme, this is, at least as far as I know, an unsolved problem generally, but we can think about how we would try to solve this. And the way that you do this is with a stabilizer formalism. And if you take only one thing away from this talk, it's the fact that the real way that you should think about performing, doing things in the one-way measurement model is using the stabilizer formalism. The only reason why I haven't been talking about it this entire talk is because I felt that that might be a little bit too dense. But, okay, so we have our geometry here. We've given names to the qubits. And, well, for those of you who know the stabilizer formalism, this is the stabilizer that we get just by considering how we're preparing the qubits. Before we perform all these entangling operations, the stabilizer is just x for all of our prepared qubits. And then when we perform our entangling operations, we induce a z on all of the neighbors of the qubits that have an x. So we get these generators. Now, geometries which have flow have the nice property that all you're doing is for each qubit that you measure, you're picking out one of these particular generators to perform as a correction. For geometries which have flow, all this means is that this set of generators won't cut it, that you need to come up with a different set of generators that will allow you to just pick and choose them for correction operations. So the first step is to find a nice set of generators. And nice set, well, there's some details, but let's say that if for each measurement you can find exactly one generator which anti-commutes and all the rest commute, then you're fine. There's some more that you can do more generally, and I won't go into that. But so for this example, this would be what I'd call a nice set of generators. And then you find some sort of measurement order. Now, this would be usually implicit in talking about how you'd find a nice set of generators. But I'll just go on from here. So we can notice that, okay, so I said that you measure everything in the plus-minus basis. What this means is that what you're looking for is to measure everything with respect to the x operation and always select for the plus-1 eigenvector. So in order to, so if we're measuring with the x operation, the reason why we're looking for anti-commuting generators is because if we get, for example, the minus state from this measurement, we want some way to change it so that we get the state as if we had gotten the plus state. And the way that we can do this is exactly by coming up with one of the stabilizer generators, which anti-commutes with our measurement. So here we notice that XA anti-commutes with, well, this stabilizer generator. So we'll just measure A, and if we don't get the measurement result we wanted, we perform that operation to correct. We don't actually have to perform this operation on A if you don't care about steering the qubit A. It's going to be measured. You're going to throw it away at the end of your computation. But we may as well talk about performing that correction on all those qubits. We don't lose anything from it. And then once we've measured, well, we know that it's going to be in the plus state after we perform that correction. So that qubit is now itself stabilized by the X operator. So we replace that stabilizer element that we had with the X operation. And then we keep on doing this. We find, well, X on X naught anti-commutes with this stabilizer element, so we measure it, we correct with that stabilizer element, and then we replace it. And we keep on going until we've measured all the qubits, in this case, all of them with X operations. Now, what we find at the end is that, well, Y0 and Y1 in the stabilizer, this is basically the stabilizer for the final set. And we find that there's absolutely no constraints on Y0 and Y1. Well, this is exactly what we would want for a unitary operation. Because if initially there were no constraints on what the input was, there should be no constraint on what the output was either. It should be basically the full set of two qubit states. So this is basically a real, I guess, crash course in the one-way measurement model. And so now we get basically to the research questions that I'm interested in looking at. And this will be the end of my talk. I'll just leave you with this. Suppose you have a geometry with a set of measurement angles, theta v, all of these for states in the xy plane on the Bloch sphere. When does this geometry represent a unitary matrix? This seems to be an unsolved problem, which I'm interested in solving. More importantly, if it represents a unitary, when does a correction scheme exist? Basically, can you say that any time you're given a geometry that represents a unitary matrix, that you can turn it into an algorithm in the one-way measurement model for performing this unitary? And basically, if we can answer this question, this would lead potentially to a new avenue of analyzing unitary operations or even devising quantum algorithms. An important question on top of that still is, if there's a correction scheme, can you efficiently find it? Because just because one exists doesn't mean that you'll be able to easily determine one. And then finally, if you have a correction scheme, can you always efficiently translate this into a circuit on a small number of qubits, as you can with geometries with flow? If you can always translate it back into a circuit, this would be a matter of saying that these two models are perfectly equivalent. They are, of course, equivalent in terms of computational power, but they're also ways of expressing operations. They're not necessarily equivalent in terms of their expressive power, kind of in an informal sense, how many ways you have of expressing a given unitary operation. If it turns out that you can't, then that would suggest something interesting about the one-way measurement model, that there's something about it that gives you more expressive power over the circuit model. And that would be something interesting to find out. All right, thank you. Any questions? Well, there's been a recent paper just at the beginning of this year talking about generalized flow. So the reason why the original thing is called a flow is because it kind of suggests paths in which the information is being transmitted. These generalized flow allow you to not exactly backtrack. It allows for individual qubits. Maybe it would be better if I drew this. So suppose you're measuring a qubit, and there's some qubits that you haven't yet measured, and some qubits which you've already measured. And you want to perform an X correction on this qubit, for instance. Well, if this qubit is adjacent to something you've already measured, this won't have a flow, because naively it's saying, well, there will be a Z correction induced on this. I can't deal with that. And if you have only one X correction for each qubit that you measured, then that's basically that will break it. But there's nothing, as I was saying before, there's nothing restricting you to performing only one X correction for every measurement that you perform. So if you have just a collection of X corrections, and two of them are adjacent to a qubit in the past, then you'll have, well, a Z correction induced by one, a Z correction induced by the other. You'll have a cancellation of those. Nothing will be done on it. So this is, I guess, maybe in some, if you don't look at it too hard, it's got some problems with information seeming to flow back into the past. But the key is that, basically, you have essentially canceling paths of information flowing back into the past. And all you care about is that you don't have to perform a correction on something that you've already measured, because the information in that qubit has already been destroyed, in a sense. Does that answer your question? Any others? That would be Daniel Brown, Elham Keshefi, Vincent Danoche, and Simon Petri, I think. Yes? I'm sorry? Sure, here. How is it computationally expensive? For the simple fact that the diagonal matrix is very large. I mean, it increases exponentially in the number of qubits that you have. There's a more compact way in which you can express it so that you're not talking about exponentially large matrices. It's compact in that basically you're only ever talking about things with the dimension of U, but then you end up having to add up an exponential number of terms. So that compact representation is maybe a more concise way of representing it, but currently we don't know anything in general for how you could efficiently compute what the unitary matrix is described by a geometry. Except if it has a flow, but then you're just going to represent it with a circuit instead of computing what the circuit performs also. Anything else? Thank you.